Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
From DW in Bonn, I'm Charlotte Lomas, and this week we're talking about food. By 2050, the global population is expected to reach more than 9 billion people, which means we're going to have a lot of mouths to feed. But ensuring food security in the face of climate change is already presenting some big challenges. Coming up on the show, we hear how people across the globe are striving for food security and in sometimes curious ways. Stay tuned to find out. And we start in the West Bank, where land has long been a point of contention. But since June this year, an area of strategic land between Jerusalem and Bethlehem has been converted into a rather unusual exhibit. The Batia Landscape Eco Museum has set up a so-called heirloom seed library, where rare and endangered Palestinian varieties of fruits and vegetables can be deposited and exchanged. Just like family heirlooms, these seeds are collected and shared over generations. Dave Kattenberg has more from Batia in the West Bank.
This is beautiful, actually. But how are we going to open this? Are we going to have a handle?
I'm standing in a little workshop in the Palestinian town of Beit Jawa, just outside Bethlehem. Local resident Vivian Sansour is an anthropologist by training, but agriculture fascinates her.
This is a drawer where we'll put some seeds, because the idea of the seed library is that...
Vivian is examining the prototype for a set of display cases where traditional varieties of Palestinian fruits and vegetables will soon be put on show, along with their seeds. These display cases will sit in the heirloom seed library Vivian is setting up in the Palestinian village of Batir, between here and Jerusalem. Batir is famous for its stone-terraced gardens covered in produce and its ancient spring-fed irrigation systems. Vivian and I drive to Batir. On our way, we pull over to buy some rare heirloom apricots, the sort she'll be promoting at her seed library.
Beit Jala has traditionally been famous for its heirloom apricots. They are to die for. And so we're on a hunt to find some. They are now, unfortunately, not so easy to find as before.
Heirloom apricots are hard to find these days because there's less land to grow them on and water is restricted. These apricots are grown on fragmented land near the Jewish settlement of Etzion.
Etzion is built on land that belongs to the people of this town and another village and another village. Israeli settlements are built on our food, our heirloom varieties, our wild varieties. Our food is being destroyed by the construction of these colonial structures.
The Palestinian-Israeli conflict is complicated. So are these apricots.
Look how deformed they look. They're just delightful.
Luscious, odd-looking apricots tell stories about land and culture in Arabic.
The heirloom apricot season here is very, very short. We say fil mishmish in the apricot season, and it's an expression that means something like when pigs fly. Like, you're not gonna make this. This is not gonna happen because it's such a short span of time.
It's the complex cultural story behind food that fascinates Vivian Sansour the most.
What I really hope happens with the seed library is that as we raise awareness about the importance of heirlooms, that we actually regenerate this love of our culture and this love of our language and really remember why we say what we say.
Vivian and I arrive in Batir after surveying the steep stone-terraced valley. The first thing you notice, and here, is water.
The water comes from the main spring where we saw earlier, and then it pours into this pool.
From this pool, water rushes down into Batir Valley through stone channels coated in green algae. Batir's 8 extended families share this water cooperatively. Their irrigation system is an engine for biological diversity.
There's mulberry tree, I can see a loquat tree, I can see a pomegranate, olives, of course, almonds, sumac, wild sumac is here. You can see mint, chards, zucchini.
Diverse farming is challenging enough. In 2004, Israel decided to extend its separation wall across Batir Valley to protect a train line snaking along the bottom. Residents petitioned Israel's high court. The train tracks have never been attacked, they argued, and the wall would wreck the valley. Their case was bolstered in 2014 when UNESCO added Batir to its list of endangered World Heritage Sites. Plans for the wall were shelved. Israel's high court ruled they could be renewed with 60 days warning. In early June, Batir Valley safe for the moment, residents and friends gathered at the village's Eco Landscape Museum to celebrate the launch of their heirloom seed library. A group of science teachers huddled around bottles filled with seeds that can be added to or drawn from.
I'm wondering what the children learn by growing things from seeds.
They learn about how to belong to the earth. That if I plant a plant, I will take care on it more.
Most of them wanted to know more about the seeds from their grandfathers and grandmothers.
These teachers are part of a science education program developed by the Ramallah-based Katan Foundation. Ziad Khalaf is the foundation's executive director.
What the students are doing now is that they're entering into a dialogue with their grandparents. The family fabric is being rejuvenated in a sense.
As the seed library launch winds down, Vivian Sansour takes guests down into the valley to where her own rare seeds are sprouting.
This is the very ancient variety of cucumber that was grown in this area. So we're hoping that we can actually make seeds from it and reintroduce it to our diet.
Ya salam, ya salam.
Vivian has collected these seeds from local Palestinian farmers. We come across an elderly gentleman named Abu Abed.
He's saying, I want to water my plants. Say, okay, fine, 5 minutes, I'll transfer the water to you.
As we gingerly navigate along the elevated borders of a set of shallow basins, water begins to trickle from one to another. Building community is what Vivian Sansour's heirloom seed library, now open and operating in Batir, Palestine, is all about.
Returning back to loving ourselves, returning back to knowing who we are, and we're reweaving our community through this project. Our community has been wounded by so much brutality. And so I think the seeds, you asked me earlier why they're magical. I think they're magical because they are also carrying in their DNA our healing and our future.
For DW Radio, I'm David Kattenberg.
From food security to insecurity, we turn to Nigeria, sub-Saharan Africa's largest tomato producer. Since May, the country has been facing a major scarcity, with prices jumping by up to 400%. The culprit of Nigeria's so-called tomatogeddon is a very small species of moth known as Tuta absoluta. The pest is affecting farmlands in Nigeria's key tomato-producing states. So why is the infestation happening on such a large scale? And has climate change got any role to play? In Lagos, our reporter Sam Olukoya went to find out.
It's a normal day in the hustle and bustle of this Nigerian market. One thing is different this time. At the vegetable stalls, there is usually an abundance of tomatoes on offer, a key ingredient in most Nigerian delicacies. But things have changed in recent weeks. A moth whose larva feeds on the tomato plant has been attacking the country's tomato farms. At the Dede tomato market in the Nigerian capital, Abuja, Mahmudu Mamoko, an official of the Market Traders Union, says the infestation has seriously affected the tomato supply to Nigerian markets.
When tomatoes were in abundance, we were taking delivery of more than 100 trucks daily. Now we are only getting 20 or 25 trucks. There are places which used to get 10 truckloads in the past, now they are lucky to get one. Some of the markets which used to unload more than 10 vehicles are now finding themselves without a single tomato.
The tomato scarcity has led to a sharp rise in the price of the staple product. At one stage, prices are said to have even jumped by as much as 400%. In a country where tomatoes are used to prepare most dishes, many people are desperate to find a way around the high price of the product. Abuja housewife Famakinwa Tosin is busy in her kitchen. She says it's been difficult cooking without fresh tomatoes.
It's not easy. The tomato problem is getting out of hand. The other time when I cannot afford to buy the fresh one, I bought dried one. Then I use it, I cook it with a tin tomato. That tin tomato, when I cook it, the taste is not the same as the fresh one.
Farmers, traders, and many others who make a living from tomatoes say they are experiencing a downturn in their businesses. Esther Obi operates a grinding machine at a roadside store. She makes a living selling tomatoes and also grinding them for her customers. But a lot of her customers have stopped coming because of the high prices. As the sole breadwinner for a family of seven, she says the whole family is suffering because of her reduced income.
It affects them because the way money used to come in before, when there was much tomatoes, the money is no more coming as it used to be. So because of that, it affects us a little.
I visited a tomato farm in order to find out more about the pest that is decimating Nigeria's tomato yields. Muhammadu Sagir, a tomato farmer in Kaduna State, is busy on his farm.
Your farm is in good shape when you leave today, but when you come back tomorrow to harvest, you may find that all the crops are infested. These moths eat everything, and we are worried about the pesticide situation. You keep putting the stuff on, but the moths have become resistant. They are immune to any pesticide we spray them with.
In 2010, Sudan was attacked by the same pest, and it took the country 3 years to recover. That's why the Nigerian government intervened by deploying experts to tackle the situation. As a result, prices for tomatoes have dropped, but they are still not back to normal. Currently, purchasing tomatoes is still 100% more expensive than it was before the crisis. For the Nigerian tomato farmer, the moth infestation is one of the two major problems affecting yields. In recent years, tomato yields have been on the decline because of a shortfall in water to irrigate the tomato farms. To grow well, tomato needs a lot of water. Emmanuel Oladipo is a professor of climatology at the University of Lagos. He says climatic factors are responsible for the shortage of water.
The effect of global warming is higher temperature than normal. And higher temperature than normal means higher evaporation than normal. And the higher evaporation than normal means less water for tomato to use, and therefore it may not yield. So if it is getting hot and you are still just irrigating, you'll be losing a lot of your water to evaporation, because it's hot. So if you use the same quantity of water you used last year and its temperature is higher this year, a lot of the water you leave is gone for evaporation. It will not go into making the tomato to yield well.
The lack of water might have contributed to the moth infestation of the tomato plants. Professor Oladipo says farmers are now irrigating their farms with all kinds of unsafe water. He says tomatoes are more prone to pests because of the contaminated water used to irrigate the farms.
They use all kinds of water which nobody knows the quality of. Most of them are from drainages. If you keep on using water from drainage, from human waste, to wet this tomato, you'd expect something will happen eventually. So let us think about this.
Nigeria's main tomato producing region is the country's semi-arid north, where irrigation is widely used on farmlands. In past years, the region has been experiencing increasing desertification and dryness, a condition blamed on global warming. But so far, not much research has been done on how the declining water supply could be influencing pest infestations. With the moths devastating the tomato harvest, Professor Oladipo says it's high time to take a closer look. For DW, I'm Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Next report, we veer west to Senegal, a country plagued by erratic rainfall, food shortages, and high unemployment. With half the country's population under 20, many people are forced to leave rural areas in search of employment. But one farming school in the region of Fimla, south of Dakar, is trying to change that. It's encouraging youth back into the fields to ensure a future generation of farmers. From there, Emmanuel Lande has more.
With the radio on and the breeze blowing through the trees, drops splash from the bucket as it's hauled out of the well and the water is poured into waiting watering cans. Like a well-oiled machine, the male students each pick up their containers in turn and start on their morning routine, shuffling between rows of leafy green cabbages, swinging the watering cans with outstretched arms. Abdelaziz Kanare's plot is a work in progress. He's been growing cabbages, papayas and even coconut trees since January when he enrolled at Kedara Farming School. The curriculum, crop diversity and agroecology, or learning to farm holistically without pesticides which pollute the ground and the environment. Senegal's rain-fed agriculture means farmers grow crops dependent on seasonal rainfall, which is becoming more erratic with climate change. Learning to grow a diversity of crops means they'll have more revenue spread out over the year and reduce their risk of crop failure. Farming this way and without chemical pesticides will help the poor quality soil regenerate nutrients as well.
Here we cultivate in the dry season as well as the rainy season. At home in my village near Sambadia, we are farmers. We only cultivate in the rainy season. We grow millet, sorghum, peanuts, but only when it rains. Here we grow organic, and it really motivated me because in my village we use pesticides and fertilizers. Here it's organic. It's good because each year, how many people are dying because of their food, the animals they eat. To change this, we need to change our farming methods.
Students only have to fulfill one criterion to join the farming school. They have to have access to a hectare of land ready and waiting for them once they leave. For Abdelaziz, his father gave him a plot and his whole village encouraged him. So he's under real pressure to succeed.
Why have people put their trust in me? Trust for me is important. It's the basis of everything. So when the whole village is mobilized and tells me they're behind me, it puts pressure on me, so I have to follow the course as best as I can. My parents only agreed to let me come here because I had the backing of the village. Without that, they would have refused.
Today, the farming scheme that began as an experiment in 2007 in the region of Fimla has brought hope back to villages where the soils have been depleted due to the spread of peanut monoculture as a cash crop under French rule. The vision of Kedara's founder, Gora Ndiaye, is to repopulate Senegal's farmland with pesticides-free farms that focus on crop rotation and diversity to help soils replenish themselves. The project is spearheaded every year by 20 young, able villagers that otherwise would likely face unemployment.
L'agriculture.
Agriculture is a means of development for us. Without agriculture, we will go nowhere. For me, every Senegalese has his role to play. We can't wait for a solution from the government.
Since the days of colonization, agriculture has focused on cash crops like rice and peanuts. Yet due to poor or regular harvests, rice still represents around 75% of total cereal imports. Other imported staples such as wheat, flour, milk or dairy products are impacted by inflation when food prices rise on the global market. Situated on several hectares of lush land, Kedara Farming School is a haven of greenery and shade. Sandy paths meander their way between greenhouses flanked by coconut palms. Each crop is planted at a specific time, so there's always something to harvest.
Pour changer la donne, il faut aller dans le village.
To change the game, we need to go into the villages, set up a farm that will be the envy of everyone. This farm will train the rural youth, set them up and support them to become farmers instead of sitting there cultivating peanuts and millet for 3 months of the year and then doing nothing for the remaining 9 months.
Each student will leave the farm with his crop capital. Crops he's farmed during the year, around 35 coconut palms, onions and cabbages. Awa Diara is 25. Her father called her back from Dakar, where she was working as a housemaid, to enroll in the farm school. She jumped at the opportunity.
We have a great responsibility because it is us, the young people, who must group together and return to the fields and farm again, because agriculture is dormant now, since all the young people have left the agricultural trade. But to avoid this, we need to return to the field to show that we are the daughters of farmers.
The school has been saving its seeds to be less reliant on global seed companies that controversially impact the regeneration of crops, pushing farmers to buy new seeds every year. At Kedara, in keeping with a traditional way of thinking, women are seen as the keepers of fertility, so they are in charge of looking after the seeds. Kadja Kamara works at the seed bank.
Earlier, all the farmers would cultivate and harvest seeds to plant the following year. But now we've distanced ourselves from that method, since the big global companies have put in our minds that perhaps these seeds are no good. So we left our traditional seeds and moved on to hybrid seeds. Farmers have now begun to realize that when you sow these hybrid seeds, you don't end up with the same crop the following year.
Aman Usman Diop is a former student from Kedara. He graduated 3 years ago and is now living off his organic plot.
We're able to work 12 months of the year and make a living through agriculture. At the beginning of the year, we planted turnips. Then we planted sorrel, which is doing well. Then I started the onions, which we're starting to sell.
Diversifying crops means Mane has something to sell at the markets. However, the chemical-free aspect is yet to impress buyers.
It's hard to work organically because the vegetables are tasty. They're smaller and pretty. But people here prefer the bigger vegetables. Here in Senegal, we don't recognize the health benefits of organic, and we have difficulty selling them because the chemical vegetables are bigger. At the market, it's the chemical vegetables that people prefer.
The produce from Kedara is yet to receive any kind of organic certification. However, with the backing of the FAO, a new crop of students is due to start at the farm school after the summer. Even without the label, the graduate farmers are respecting the environment and in the long term helping to ensure food security for their communities all year round. For DW, Emmanuel Landet in Fimla, Senegal.
Now to France, one of the world's major agricultural exporters. French farms have often remained in the same families for generations. But that has begun to change for agricultural communities in Berry, a cereal growing region in the centre of the country. Chinese buyers looking to secure food supplies for their growing population have been purchasing farmland there, and that's causing concern among local farmers, as John Lawrenson has been finding out.
À partir de maintenant, tout ce qui est à gauche et à droite, c'est la propriété des Chinois. Tout ça, ça appartient aux Chinois.
We're driving down a country lane through what the poet Peggy, writing about this part of France, described as oceans of wheat. The man at the wheel is the farmer and local farmers' union leader, Hervé Coupeau. From here, everything you can see on the right and on the left belongs to the Chinese, he tells me.
So this is the farmhouse where the farmer used to live, right?
Oui.
Who's working this farm now? Qui travaille maintenant alors?
Casual labor. They hire people for a month or two. The rest of the year, there's no one. It's empty. With normal owners, so to speak, you'd have a family with children in the local school, a farmer's wife who'd stay on the farm or go out to work. Whichever way, there'd be life. Here, in this wide open space, there's nobody.
A company called Hongyang purchased this and several other farms, acquiring 2,100 hectares so far, wheat, barley and rapeseed mainly. Kupo says they paid over twice the market price. Locals say that after each purchase, a group of Chinese investors comes to see what they've bought. Then they eat at a local restaurant and return to China. We asked a French businessman involved in the purchases to comment. He hasn't replied to this or other requests for information. The apparent unwillingness of the buyers to explain who they are and what they're about has upped anxiety among farmers. Arnaud Morin is feeding his 80 black-faced Suffolk sheep. He also raises cattle and grows wheat.
Moi, j'ai 95% de mon exploitation en fermage. Demain, s'il y a un propriétaire...
I lease 95% of the land I farm. If one of the owners decided to sell, I wouldn't be able to afford to buy because the Chinese have pushed up the price so much. It's the same for young farmers starting up. They can no longer afford to buy land, and I don't like our land going to foreigners. The land is like our soul.
China is investing heavily in Europe, 20 billion euros last year, compared with 13 billion euros of Chinese investments in the US. And it's not the first time China has displayed interest in French agriculture. Antoine Brunet is a retired economic advisor to the HSBC Bank, and he's author of China's Strategy to Rule the World.
Les Chinois, par exemple, avaient acheté beaucoup de vignobles dans le Bordelais. Également, il y a eu...
The Chinese have bought a lot of vineyards in the Bordeaux area. And in the dairy sector, they bought a 20% stake in a big dairy cooperative in Normandy, which means, indirectly, they part own the land. They know that in the future, China will need to source a lot of food abroad, so they have started to do what they have already done in other places. In Africa and Latin America, they have even brought in their own farm laborers to work the land they've bought.
Back in Berry, I visit a second, then a third farm sold to the Chinese. Lots of shiny machinery, not a soul. At the last one, there are still curtains on the farmhouse windows, but this is the only inhabitant I meet.
Ah, well, you're quite sweet.
Local attorneys here have told Kupo that the Chinese plan to ultimately buy 20,000 hectares. If they do that, he says, they'll be able to fill a freight train with a harvest and ship it to China. John Lawrenson, DW, Berry, Central France.
One, two, three.
Well, that wraps up today's show. Thanks to our studio team, and thank you for tuning in. If you'd like to listen to past episodes, just download the Living Planet podcast on iTunes or visit our website at dw.com/environment. And if you'd like to share your thoughts and comments with us, you can email us at livingplanet@dw.com or just tweet us at @dw_eco. I'm Charlotta Lomas. Catch you next week.
The sloppy suit. Admit it, girl, that I can't dig it. And I said, Sogum, 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 Sogum. Now, baby, you're casting your spell on.